Hello.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
Yeah, I'm
Good to hear you.
okay. Yeah, that's a bit odd.
Ah, the wonders of Skype. It was ringing on all my other devices, but not this one, but it was showing that you were calling.
Yeah.
So let me make sure that this is showing online. Welcome anyway. Good to have you back.
Okay, sure.
Interesting time at the moment, isn't it? What has been capturing your eye? Tell us a little bit about some of the comments that we were thinking of throwing each other's way.
Yeah, well, it's quite a surreal market at the moment, isn't it? It's a proper summer melt-up. I don't think I've really seen this since 2013. Market's giving a lot of conflicting signals, and you need to be a little bit careful because, of course, some of these volumes are just wafer thin, particularly in cash equity. You've got a host of contradictions, so let me just touch upon some of them. Obviously, you and I have mentioned before the amount of event risk out there, geopolitical, economic, etc. And yet you've seen a broad-based collapse in asset price volatility. So, for instance, particularly in your beloved area of FX, we've gone in mid-June, actually predating the UK referendum outcome, we've gone from an 18-month high in implied FX volatility to an 8-month low. In 2 months, you've seen a parallel move in the VIX, in V2X on Euro stocks implied volatility. We've seen the MOVE index on US Treasury bond volatility collapse as well. So really, the market is saying, a lot of superficially, there's a lot in the world to be worried about. But the markets are saying, seem to be saying, in terms of volatility, and as much as volatility gives you an indication on risk, is that everything is plain sailing. It does feel like the silence of the grave, but we haven't seen this sort of coordinated pullback in asset volatility for quite some considerable length of time. And it's interesting. This is we've coming out of earnings season now, second quarter, so we're about the 90% mark on FTSE 100, Euro stocks, S&P 500, and you'd have to say that it's not been great. Yes. Ostensibly, the US is about a 4% beat, but we play this game where we downgrade into print and then we declare victory. You're not seeing earnings numbers coming up for the year or indeed next year. Europe has been worse despite very low expectations, so that earning momentum is still heading down. UK is a bit of a special case because you did have that immediate post-Brexit vote. Philip on the dollar earners, on the FX earners within the FTSE 100, which I know you've been quite focused on recently, but now that's trailing off as well. And so you've got this mismatch. You've got this mismatch. As I said, you've actually got the flattest US Treasury yield curve you had since the end of 2007. So if you look at the 10 versus 2 yield, it's very, very flat. And normally, this is some indication of the kind of growth profile you've got going forward. Now, if you
Well,
so if
it's
you go,
normally an
yeah.
indicator for a very dark times. And at
Well,
the
it's
same time as
inverse.
that's happening, is you have the three major indices making new highs,
Yeah.
which is this dichotomy of complete perverted misery and projected future pain versus champagne cork popping new highs.
Yeah, it's bond market. It's basically it's bond market push as against equity earnings pull. Yeah, so it's like pushing toothpaste out from the bottom of a tube is really effectively what we're seeing at the moment. I noted just before we came online, I was noting that the two best performing sectors this year globally have been materials. Metals, etc., and energy, mostly oil. Yeah. And these are sectors which traditionally do quite well when you're towards the end of an economic cycle, and the global economy is running perhaps above trend. You're starting to see inflationary pressure come through, and these things tend to do well. Well, you can't honestly say we are in that position at the moment. We're certainly not heading towards that position. And ominously, the sector which has fared the worst is again banks and European banks. Are undoubtedly at the epicenter of that, but they are certainly not alone in struggling. one would have to say, and bearing in mind that, you know, we are supposedly come out of a financial, very much bank-centric crisis, to see these things still struggling, I think is quite ominous. But in the meantime, we've still got some of these industries making new highs. We're still seeing these multiples expand. All I'm saying is there's very little bottom-up to actually support this melt-up. But you do feel like it's somewhat inexorable, as I think you mentioned earlier on, in respect to the FTSE 100. This is probably most, in some respects, the most hated rally we've seen in a very, very long time.
Yeah, this is my take. I can't see this whole narrative in the isolation of, without bringing in Carney's bazooka, and similar actions by other correlated, coordinated cartel, central banker, Goldman Sachs type elites. So he did what the Eurozone did. He started to buy corporate bonds. He's secured the right to buy private, I mean, listed as well, but non-governmental debt.
Yeah.
In the firm of, further to that, he cut rates by 25% and added to the currency destruction, was it 75 billion into the fire? And suggested that the final quarter that we have yet to sacrifice to zero may go, and further QE may be possible. So apart from doing attacks on three fronts across the board, he also said further of all of the above may be possible. I think this is you mentioned the low volatility. This is your driver. These guys are saying, we're going to be, the buck stops with us. We're going to keep printing and pretending and currency destroying and pumping liquidity till the cow comes home. And my main belief system around that is because, of course, it drops government borrowing costs.
Yeah.
So it frees government to be a spender of last resort.
Yeah.
Even further, to continue to build ever-escalating deficits on the basis that he's eked out a bit more affordability. So if you were paying 0.5, you're now paying 0.25. You're actually paying a whole damn side less.
Yeah.
He also looks after, there are some retail people that get looked after. The metropolitan elite with who've put down 50% on a £10 million London home and have a £5 million mortgage tied to the Bank of England rate. They are smiling, but it wasn't for them specifically that they did it. Man in the street who can't afford a home.
Yeah.
This does nothing for them apart from destroying their currency. So the buying power of their currency diminishes immensely. And they have no assets. They don't have a rocking great share portfolio in the US or here, which, while the markets continue to melt up for the summer, in the very low, on very low implied VIX, which means it's early stages bull market that could go a lot further. So the 99% are feeling terrible because they're being dragged into higher tax. Their disposable income has never been hurt so much. And the elites are doing, while tutting the poor, you know, 99%ers are continuing to pursue policies that protect government and high net worth people by virtue of inflating certain asset prices that only the elite few have in any great scale, which is top end property. And the other thing that's happening is the London property market has turned down quite viciously. And London property is like the US stock market for wealth, feel good factor. And I think the stats have been coming through, and this was well pre-Brexit, another thing that will be blamed on Brexit, no doubt. But well pre-Brexit, we came into this year with already threats of a slowdown, and it had been manifesting, and it continued, and the trend has continued, much like many other things pre-Brexit. In other words, we were rounding off for a decline, regardless what the referendum was. And I continue to assert that we're in a remain state at the moment anyway. We haven't Brexited and we've not even started a Brexit. So we are in a remain state, just a more uncertain one. And so all these things have gone on. So they are pumping up the big spenders of the property market by trying to soften the crash in the top-end property market in London and the general London market, because they will all be affected. And of course, they're giving a bid to assets like the equities. And equities, while many, particularly in the US, are deemed overvalued, given the scarcity of options and the negative yields on bonds, which is a clear bubble, and deficits expanding on an epic rate, and government being given a free rein to spend cheaply, and which they are doing, the only option is to pay for the relatively overvalued equities that at least pay a positive earnings stroke divvy stream, versus guaranteed loss of value and probably a reset to zero at some point on what is the biggest bond bubble. So a lot of the bond kings all have issued very foreboding statements about the state of the debt market. So Carney is just protecting and trying to extend the game in the bond market to ever higher capital appreciation of bonds and lowness of cost for government spending. That's my take. And by doing so, supporting, creating more money, devaluing everybody else's money, so your buying power is reduced, but all that $75 billion he's created has got to go chase a yield. So where does it go? It goes to the equity market.
Yeah. The thing is, it's a bit of a closed loop, though, isn't it, Francis? Because at the end of the day, you know, you've got to own assets in order to benefit from this asset price inflation. And this liquidity is basically a closed loop. It hasn't gone into the real economy.
No, it's not helicopter money, is it? It's not been dropped to the individuals.
No. It's been selectively dropped to the people who already have a lot of money.
Exactly.
In as much as it's
and who are already big investors, and the minute they get this cheap largesse, they continue to invest it in the place they think is the least overvalued.
Yeah. So, I mean, you mentioned, for instance, I mean, the bond market rally. Ongoing bond market rally has reduced government borrowing costs. And one could easily make the case, well, actually, yes, on a static basis, we don't want to be taking advantage of that, inverted commas, in order to increase government spending, because our deficits are already relatively high, because our debt levels are already relatively high. The issue I would say against that is that, you know, a lot of work's been done to suggest that, you know, the sort of fiscal multipliers which apply these sort of situations can be significantly above one. So, you know, rather than trying to, you know, crush the denominator on the government debt equation, we should be doing more to actually inflate the numerator. And I think, you know, just using a UK specific example, I think it's crazy in a situation where you've got, right at the moment, let me have a look, UK gilts, 1.3%. That's where the UK government can borrow now to be paying effectively the French and the Chinese governments to build Hinkley Point and by guaranteeing them for 35 years a wholesale rate of electricity more than double that. And by the way, it implied public subsidy of over £30 billion when we can borrow at that rate. That just seems like a scandalous waste of money. So I think that a lot of missteps are being made. I think ultimately we are going to get drawn into a game other than central banks. I think it is looking quite tired. I think the markets retains to some extent its enthusiasm, but you know, we have to bear in mind that most indices, certainly outside of the US, are well below previous highs, and ultimately the growth numbers aren't coming through, and they're not going to come through because this economically is a dead end. You know, these sort of closed loops of liquidity that we've outlined are real, they're ongoing, and we know that they don't actually do anything for the general economy. And meanwhile, the 99%...
They hurt the economy because they diminish.
Yeah.
They diminish the buying power for the rest.
Yes.
When they QE. So they are squeezing the masses. They were saying something I saw in the Guardian headline, but it will be consumers that will determine the recovery and all of this. Well, where are the consumers getting any money?
Well, they're not, because they're generally speaking, they're not getting wage increases. You know, this is the thing.
Getting wage increases, they're getting increased cost because the declared inflation rate and what people are paying at the tills is far, far higher. And at the same time, they're getting laid off. Companies are cash cowing. So yep. they are growing earnings per share marginally on decreasing revenue lines and rationalizations.
And share buybacks, of course, is flattering.
And share buybacks on cheap debt.
Yeah, because when quite often when market commentators talk about earnings growth, what they're actually talking about is earnings per share growth on a lower share count. So yeah, you're right. It's a very tricky. I mean, really, this is, you know, and again, we've touched on this before. It's the Japanification of the global economy. We know where that ends. We saw some very poor.
I don't know if I agree with it being Japanification. Yeah. It's the corporatocracy. It's the corporatization. Japan is quite unique and has a few things in its favor that we do not. In terms of who holds the debt, it's a self-contained Ponzi scheme, at least when they print money, because their citizens take the other end and are prodigious savers.
Yes,
we don't have the buffers that the average Japanese tourist has.
Of course, Francis, I mean, the savings rates, the household savings rate in Japan has remorselessly ground lower. So, I mean, thank goodness it was coming from such an elevated level in the first place. But one thing which is absolutely common is this hoarding of cash at the corporate level. It's been problematic in Japan for years, and you've had various shareholder activists coming in. The sort of Elliott investors of, you know, Children's Trust, you know, etc., trying to come in and shake up and get these balance sheets actually working a bit more effectively. But they're not doing it. And despite Shinzo Abe imploring companies to pay their workers more, knowing that that's likely to get recycled back into the real economy, of course, surprise, surprise, they haven't done it. You know, any more than they're doing it in the UK or the rest of Europe. And, it's interesting, isn't it? Because, I mean, traditionally, you'd have stocks rallying on news that you're going to reduce headcount, you say, well, reducing costs. I mean, this is ongoing in the banking sector, for instance, which are generally relatively well-paid jobs.
And not exclusively so, though. You know, IBM are laying off tons of people, a lot of other corporations, large corps, are sandbagging their earnings with hollowing out in the middle.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a collapse of the middle class, and you know, I can't remember where we touched on this last time on the record, but you know, one thing that worries me in terms of the you know, socio-geopolitical dimension is if the people's stake in society is eroded. So let's say, you know, you don't have a career anymore. You don't even have a job anymore. You just have a series of gigs. It's the gig economy. And you don't have a mortgage anymore because you can't afford a mortgage. You can't even get on the housing ladder. And you don't feel that, you know, social mobility is increasing. It's actually decreasing. And you don't feel your children are going to have a better life than you. You actually think they're probably going to have a worse, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, you don't feel enfranchised by the political system, which is why we're seeing people like Trump. Now, these are all, you know, they used to be tick marks, yeah, and they would keep you embedded in the system and they would keep you on side. These things are all being knocked away. So there's relatively little now for people just to say, you know, do you know what? I, to hell with all of this. You know, I'm not going to play this game anymore. I'm just going to flip the whole board up and the pieces will fall where they may. And that undoubtedly, to me, that undoubtedly was an element in the Brexit vote. Yeah, people saw the way things were going. They didn't like the way they seemed to be going. So they thought, well, do you know what? Let's change this game because we're tired of playing the old game. And that's what, you know, as you would describe it, the elite just could not comprehend. They couldn't comprehend how anybody could possibly not want the future which they themselves had mapped out. Complete incomprehension. You know, I was spending that Friday morning of you know, immediately after the vote, you know, on the trading floor in the company of a number of other people, and most of them were ranting, absolutely ranting. They just could not understand what had just happened, and saying, well, these people are so stupid, they shouldn't be allowed the vote, and so on and so forth. You know, and I've got to admit, I was laughing because I was like, how could you not see this coming? So anyway, I think my only sort of concluding thought on this thread is that if people feel that Brexit or what stood behind Brexit was an outlier, and you know, we can blame dumb Brits on all the world's ills and just, you know, just say we're going to soldier on, I think that's profoundly mistaken. I think it's you know, it's indicative of some much bigger forces which are in play right now and will continue to play out over the years ahead. And will unpack, it will determine the shape of governments. It will certainly determine the shape of markets going forward for the foreseeable future.
I agree.
Wow. I agree.
I think we could be bullish longer than people realize. And I think this is what I fear. Too many people are, you know, you got in touch regarding Bloomberg and everybody getting really excited about an RSI crossing over into the top third, top 30%, you know, a whole bunch of alerts suddenly dropping, and everyone, what do they all become? They become short callers on the FTSE.
Yeah.
As it approached 7,000, and they think, well, it didn't go very far past 7,000 last time. It's going to come back again.
Yeah.
But what they forget is when it was touching the 7,000 and going above the 7,000 levels previously, it was, in fact, a pound of about 1.56 to the dollar.
Yeah.
So there's a complete underestimation of the currency destruction effect that has been specific to the UK recently.
Yes.
Although all economies are at it and all central banks are passing the baton around to beat their own currencies up, it's certainly been Britain's turn. And there's possibility and likelihood of further, as Carney has indicated, very, very bearishly for the pound, that there might be more, and he'll throw the last quarter into the fire. The only thing he appears to have drawn a line under for now is the in negative. And then you've got the resources like gold and silver, which have been stirring really well, because the carry costs of gold and silver are no longer significant if you're talking about negative bond yields.
Sure.
Next to that. And you have the dollar, a lot of UK's equities, as you've already said, being pound hedge with large percentages of their revenue. This could go stronger for longer. And as we pointed out, there's an inverted head and shoulders. I don't tend to overemphasize reversal patterns performance, but they do, you know, once they've happened and they're triggered, they do get to their targets on occasion.
Yeah.
And that's pointing at just sub 7,300, which would be a new high for the FTSE, although it'll be on a weak pound and strong metals. I don't think it's a big ask. It's 65% of the way there.
No, I mean, if you look at the dynamics in terms of volatility, in terms of positioning, in terms of what the central banks are still continuing to do, the only issue is, and this is what happens in the, should we say, the general, not even the general media, even the financial media, they'll always say, well, if this is going up, therefore it must be good news. Yeah. But of course, we know for a fact, because we've seen it repeated again and again, that there's quite often in markets, particularly equity markets, being a bad news is good news dynamic. Yeah, so bad news, bond yields collapse even further, pushes everybody into higher yielding assets, and equity goes up. Yeah, so you're actually ending up with, obviously, bond markets go up. Yeah, yields down, bond market goes up, equity market goes up, credit market goes up. You know, so. All of a sudden, everybody who's long financial assets is doing really, really well. The problem is, of course, eventually you end up with I call this sort of, you know, Wile E. Coyote moment, and you go, oh my goodness, we're now, instead of paying 20 times earnings for something which isn't growing, we're now paying 50 times earnings for something which isn't growing.
I've got to add to this.
Yeah.
You may recall last year we were in the finishing stages of a multi-year emerging market currency crisis that all had big geometrical targets to the upside that were all being met, and was the end for the dollar strength against the peso, the lira, the rand, and a whole bunch. And I said, that means we're going to get a bit of pullback strength of the emergings against the dollar for a sustained period after these targets have been run. And actually, the best place to have been investment category-wise would be emerging market debt, because if the interest rate in South Africa is around 10%, you could have bought government debt there yielding God knows what, but it would be double digits. Plus, you will have had the rand go from 17 to the dollar to 13, upper 13s. So you would have picked up a massive lump of currency appreciation, running into the regions of, you know, 30%. Plus, you would be having a double-digit yield on interest rates. And what we've actually seen is a reverse wash into relative value into the emerging markets, while the first world markets and currencies all are taking the bath. So now it's the dollar and the pound that are weak, and you've actually got a situation where I'd just love to get that high for you. I think it traded, I take the rand as one of them because I go there often, but it's the same for the likes of the peso, the even with Turkey's news flow, which is usually quite atrocious. They have been cut some slack as well from their highs. So the interesting element of this is that the dollar power has been calmed and the emerging markets have suddenly got a bid back again underneath them.
Yeah. And yeah, nobody believes
there'll be quite a bit of hot money in there. The question is, can we call when that ends again? Because end it will.
Yeah, I mean, from the emerging market equity side as well, I mean, you had sort of late-ish last year, I think it was 11-year low of emerging market globally against their developed peers on cash equity. So, yeah, I mean, it just nobody was there. You know, only the most dedicated money was left there. All the discretionary stuff had just been, you know, flushed out, the international investors, you know, the global, you know, discretionary global allocation, all gone. All gone. I mean, now we're seeing a bit of a barbelling, aren't we? Because we're seeing, on one hand, we've seen effectively a capitulation on continental European equities. You know, we've actually still seen, despite the performance of the FTSE 100, and obviously one has to take into account that, you know, where the pound has gone as well. But you've still seen investors, generally speaking, underweight that market. So that's become a bit of a pain trade. But so they've really gone piled into the US. That's certainly helped that market onto recent highs. And then at the other end, they've gone for emerging markets. So there's this barbell, and they've gone from, you know, what they view as the safest as the safe and, you know, shall we say, reassuringly expensive in the US. And they've gone for, you know, for a bit of juice, they've gone from emerging markets. And anything.
I think that'll be the debt markets, particularly.
Yes.
If you'd bought, I've just pulled up the RAND chart while you were talking, just to give you just one of many examples, and we can go through a few others. But in January of this year, the RAND was 17.76 at its worst to the dollar.
Right.
That is now 13.33. So on currency appreciation, you've picked up 4.5 off 17. You've got nearly 25% gain in 8 months, just on currency effect. Plus, now you're earning a double-digit yield on your emerging market debt.
Yeah,
and they're not going to fail on that. I don't think they've ever failed.
Yeah, ironically. Well, you see, high yield generally do pretty well. Yeah, generically, high yield has done well. I mean, some of this has been flattered because many of these high yield indices are quite long on energy companies, and we have seen, you know, oil, you know, execute a significant bounce from its lows earlier on this year. But even so, you know, in an environment where central banks are still easing policy, where they're still endeavoring to compress risk spreads, you know, and be, as we touched upon earlier on, you know, active in the corporate bond market as well, it's no surprise that, you know, high yield's a pretty hot area. And that's probably the most, if you look at it, in terms of asset class, that's probably the most crowded trade out there at the moment. As I said, on cash equity, it's a bit more mixed. Bonds are generally perceived to be overbought, though, you know, as we've seen with that failed reverse auction in UK gilts last week, you've got a lot of asset liability matching going on by, you know, holders such as pension funds, life funds, etc., who need to hold this stuff no matter what. If I were looking for stress in this market going forward, I'd probably look to high yield because that's where.
Are you talking about, say, emerging market government bonds, or would you be talking about US-based junk bonds?
Well, I think more US-based junk to be honest, because I think the thing that would really trigger a significant shakeout in the emerging market sphere is going to be a stronger dollar. And that doesn't seem to be in prospect. I mean, the market's saying maybe a 1 in 4 chance of a Fed rate hike September 21st. So, I mean, that's a potentially a trigger. But as I said, and you could take the view, you know, that flat yield curve that I mentioned earlier, market almost certainly being overly complacent. They're either overly complacent on the rate outlook, or if they're correct on the rate outlook, then they should probably be a little bit more circumspect about credit, is the way I look. There is an internal inconsistency. Because if the global economy, the outlook is accurately reflected in that bond market, that sovereign bond market, then it does imply that corporate growth, corporate cash flows, etc., are going to be nowhere near as healthy as perhaps these other markets more directly linked to that actually are pricing in.
Yes. Interesting. By the way, I gave you the dollar. During that same period, the pound went from 25.8 to 17.
On the rand?
To the rand, yeah. So, I mean, if you were a UK pension and you took a, you know, 11 or 12% yielding bond, you will have also picked up capital appreciation to the tune of the better part of 8 over 25. That's 30% with the Brexit devaluation.
Yeah.
So you made 30% and you've picked up eight months of 12, three quarters, you can argue, or certainly
two-thirds
of year's worth at about 12% yield as well.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't have been a bad trade.
You can get a holiday after that, can't you, really?
Exactly. I mean,
our work here is done.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's turned very much out to be that case. And I wonder what will be the thing that will point everything back at the emerging market currencies, and when will the pressure come back on them. And as you've said, the dollar strength is one part of that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you'd like to think that some of the stuff going on within these countries themselves would shake investor confidence, but doesn't, as you mentioned Turkey, well, you know, that's pretty big, but, you know, doesn't seem to have made a great deal of difference, you know, in terms of the appetite for emerging markets. I mean,
it hasn't pulled back near as much as, say, this.
No, it hasn't.
But you still will have, from the absolute high of January, you're still slightly below that. I had a look at the lira. I had a look at the peso. Both are below their absolute highs at the beginning of the year. So you will have had some currency appreciation if you'd bought in and around January.
Yeah,
and of course, you will have also had the yield, the higher yield.
Yeah, and the lira has been very choppy against the dollar. I mean, you look at
wild swings. It would have been very bumpy.
But
broadly, you're down. The dollar's lost.
But I mean, I think, you know, looking, you know, you mentioned the RAM. I mean, you know better than I, because, you know, you're down there quite frequently. But, you know, you look at the political situation there, apart from anything else, and the sort of the economic ramifications of that.
The irony is actually the ANC is losing power, which is actually quite a positive thing. And I think that's
ultimately. But I mean, do you think that transition is going to be seamless? I doubt it.
No, nothing seamless ever in Africa.
exactly.
I'd say nothing seamless in many places.
Yeah.
It's nonetheless, that's quite good news flow, because it does mean Zuma is unpopular and finally people are no longer voting for, you know, the men who came out of the jungle with a rifle anymore. It's more about what have you done for me lately? And it's given power to the DA, which is the Democratic Alliance, which was a bit of an old white liberal party, which is more like a conservative party here. But they have now black leadership as well, and they're attracting people across the board. So that's actually quite a positive development. But even still, the other emergings, if we just leave the RAND out, I think they've maybe been a bit of a good luck story, although with Zuma still there, it's only to a point. But the others have done reasonably well. They've held their own despite terrible news flow. So it shows to us how weak the dollar is being kept. And then when you look at the pound dollar exchange, you know that the pound is even below that in how it's performed.
Well, it's the bottom of the pile on G10, isn't it, year to date?
Absolutely. And we can thank Carney for that tax on our holidays and all those other things, because he's gone out and out to kill it. And he's not serving the man in the street by doing that. He's serving the government and their government borrowing costs. And this is what I keep wanting people to understand. They don't care about your growth and details. They serve the system. They serve the system of needs, and they are all on a circular, a circle jerk of currency destruction. You know, the Japanese had to do it first with the three arrows, and I think they've done and shot their bolt, and I don't think there's any further appetite for doing much more. And I think the yen will probably be the leader paper currency of the year. But we've certainly had Draghi do his bit of anything of its take, and Carney's now taken up the challenge. And he's hurting us with everything he does there. Unless you've got a mega mortgage on a Bank of England rate, you're getting very little back and your money's being devalued. And even if you do have, it swings in roundabouts, and it depends on how much you're saving on that mortgage versus how much you having to spend extra for a similar standard European holiday, everything else you import that comes from Euroland and pay more for, etc., etc. So I think it's a tragedy, and I don't celebrate his bazooka, and he's not serving us. He's disserving us, in my view, but serving the system that supports him, which is what he's elected to do.
Well, yeah, I guess shorthand, it's a policy designed by the rich for the benefit of the rich, and it speaks to the paucity of creative or critical thinking that, you know, we're now 8 years on for the crisis. From the crisis, and we're still just banging away at the same old drum, even though it's palpably failed to actually reignite growth or solve many of the world's ills. And of course, you know, they will say things would have been worse had they not done this, because their models tell them that they've made a difference. But I suspect
worse for whom? Worse for the cost of the government to borrow, yes. I'm happier with cheaper European holidays and imported items and sustaining the buying power of my currency. Anything that diminishes the buying power of your currency is a tax by different name, that's all. It's a tax upon you. It's further austerity on you, because you need more pounds to achieve the same purchase. And that's how they put a tax on you. And the people who get the benefit are the government. So the people who are getting the gift of that tax are the most indebted, who are linked to a BOE indebtedness rate, which is the government as the primary borrower. Yeah.
And the people who have the ability to diversify their sterling exposure. Obviously, that's beyond the means of the man on the street, as they say. I mean, you're going to be diversified in financial assets, because that's effectively is the at least the proximate target of all this central bank activity that's going on. And of course, you can be in other currencies, and you know, and there's no. That's one of the reasons why the Panama Papers are in Panama.
Exactly. Very, very good. David, any parting shot that you'd like to make, advice for the viewers and listeners, or opinion that you'd leave? What's your take on it? Is it a summer melt-up? Should we all be long the FTSE 100?
Yeah, I think it is a summer melt-up. As I said, I mean, this is all subject to incredibly low volume. I mean, we keep thinking the volumes can't get any lower, but they have. it's not helped today, you know, as we record today, it's, it was an Ascension Day. Or was it Assumption Day? I don't know. I'm not in the Catholic Church, but I think it's Assumption Day. So markets are very, very thin. So we might get, you know, a bit of intraday choppiness. But, yeah, it just feels like there's, you know, politicians have gone, on holiday for the summer. So they're not going to say anything particularly stupid. Everybody's expecting more from central banks. If the market was going to react to what I think, as I said before, has been quite a poor earnings season, it would have already done so. We just seem to be, you know, getting sucked, into this vacuum, as it were. but it's not a healthy place to be. It is ultimately it's another form of momentum trade, and it does concern me that the fundamentals aren't really there. But you know, if I were forced to say if the is the next move up or down, well, it looks like it's going to continue to be up.
Exactly, it's very, very interesting, and I think it could go. I think do not be short this market is my take, and potentially be long. I think there's upside to it. I think we could make a new high, which I call, while that sounds groundbreaking, I think you need to see the context that it's in a highly additionally liquidized world with a further 75 billion thrown at it, with the pound trading at all-time lows across comparison to all others. So the relative valuation when compared at a global macro level doesn't actually mean we've advanced that far, as it sounds. And I think people need to understand that. People need to view assets as a global macro hedge fund manager does, where money can flow anywhere in the world. So the market can go up if the currency is cheap, because those companies are earning dollars and Australian dollars and other large percentages of global currency stakes, and their value is decreasing every time the pound falls.
Yeah, I mean, so, FTSE 100 is not UK PLC, is it? Quite, in fact, I would say quite the opposite. And also, the more general point I would make is just because the price is going up doesn't, because people try to link news flow with price.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, financial journalists do it all the time. They go, well, oh, why is it up? Why is it down? And sometimes you can find a fundamental reason. Sometimes you have to dig quite deeply.
They think the market moves are an economic indicator.
Exactly.
And they deeply mistaken. It's just an indicator of where the asset liquidity flows are flowing to and from.
Exactly. And you have to understand what the opportunity set is there in order, you know, to accurately calibrate what the FTSE 100 is doing, for instance.
Absolutely. Good point. Well made. Very nice talking to you, Mike. And I look forward to getting this podcast up and sharing the link with you. Thank you very much. And let's do this again soon.
My pleasure as always, Francis. You take care.
All the best. Bye-bye.